You may know Rebecca as a 1938 novel by Daphne du Maurier. You might know it as a 1940 adaptation directed by Alfred Hitchcock that won Best Picture. But if you've always wanted a version with Armie Hammer playing the role once occupied by Laurence Olivier, Netflix is on it.
The new Rebecca stars Lily James as a woman who becomes the second wife of Maxim de Winter, played by Armie Hammer. When she gets to his massive estate, she finds it occupied by his housekeeper, played here by Kristen Scott Thomas. It's also haunted by the memory of his first wife. Her name was Rebecca, and I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about Netflix's Rebecca on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Stephen from his home studio bunker is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And also with us is our own Aisha Harris. Hey, Aisha.
Hello, Linda.
Good to be here with all three of you. For anyone who's not familiar with Rebecca, the book or the Hitchcock movie, just understand it's basically a three-person examination of sort of jealousy, memory between the second wife, who, by the way, does not have a name, so we can just call her Lily James. And that's true in the book, too. And Maxim is the second person. And then Mrs. Danvers, the housekeeper, is the third person. Mrs. Danvers adored Rebecca, the first wife, the dead first wife. She's constantly undermining Lily James by emphasizing how perfect Rebecca was. But there's a lot to uncover, as it turns out, about the marriage of Rebecca and Maxim. I want to go to Aisha first. Now, Aisha, as I understand it, you had not read the book and also had not previously seen the Hitchcock movie. So you came into this fairly fresh. Talk to me about your reaction to Rebecca just as a Netflix movie.
Yes. Well, I am kind of ashamed to be outed as having not seen the Hitchcock version. So watching this, I was coming to it very fresh-eyed, and I really think the story is incredibly fascinating. I'm sad that it took me this long to get to it and that this was the first version that I encountered, because there's just so much going on here that is right up my alley and I just find really, really interesting and to pick apart the way there are so many twists and you think it's going one way and then out of nowhere it goes another way. No, actually, Max didn't love his wife. They had a very difficult relationship, and then he might have murdered her, and she might have also been having an affair. She might have been pregnant. Like, all these things are happening, and I really, really like the way in which it's trying to discuss the ideas of obsession and female relationships and the way in which men view women and the way in which people view women either as a pedestal, as something to compare each other to. These are all really, really interesting things to pick apart. And I think the problem with this Netflix film is that the execution just feels very sterile in many ways. Part of it for me was the aesthetics. I think Gothic horror and the ways in which it can be filmed and depicted on film, there's a lot of opportunity to do things with shadows and light. And this felt to me like it had this weird kind of like sheen to it that felt like it was going for Talented Mr. Ripley.
I was just going to say that.
But wasn't quite as pretty. Like, it, and the CGI effects were less scary and creepy than they were just like, oh, yeah, this looks like CGI. Like, it doesn't feel
big
scary.
Time.
And so I had issues with that. And then I also just had issues with poor Armie Hammer. I mean, he's a beautiful, beautiful man if you're into that conventional beefcake type. But he was attempting to do some sort of, I know it's supposed to be in the UK, Britain, but he's doing some like weird mid-Atlantic accent that's not quite working for me. And Lily James was just fine. I will say, I did like Kristen Scott Thomas as Mrs. Danvers. I thought she was bringing something to that role that really worked for me. And she was the most chilling part of it. And so she was a plus. But overall, meh.
Yeah. Glenn, you go back a long way with the Hitchcock movie, but not the book. Talk to me about your reaction.
Yeah, well, I did rewatch the 1940 version again before watching this, which is by any measure a mistake. Don't do that. Because, of course, it's unfair to compare this little Netflix knockoff to what is, as you mentioned, a Best Picture winner. It was also, you know, considered a classic. It is also Alfred Hitchcock's first U.S. film. But it is inevitable that we must compare them because you made your own damn bed. You remade Rebecca.
Right.
And it is a straight-up remake. Nothing is really reimagined here. Now, they could say they've just readapted the novel, but they kept a lot of the changes that Hitchcock made, so that doesn't hold a lot of water for me. Now, I hadn't seen the 1940s version since college when I took a Hitchcock film course, and that was the film course where I heard the term male gaze for the first time, and I swear to God, for the first, like, 4 weeks of this course, every time the professor would mention Hitchcock's male gaze, I'd be sitting there in my seat going, so you got Farley Granger, and does Tony Perkins count? That is an entirely true story. Okay, so the thing about the 1940 version, it really steers into the swooning gothic mystery of it all, and with an accent on swooning, because that is a polite Hays Code era word for horny. This is a very horny movie. Everyone is breathlessly panting after everyone else, and the performances are bigger in that movie. In the way that cinema was at the time, you know, Florence Bates plays the narrator's employer, Edith Van Hopper, and she goes really big. She's like, oh, Maxim, what are you doing in Monte, you know? And you got the great George Sanders. He is perfect, patron saint. He is a cad and a bounder, and finally you have Judith Anderson. Judith Anderson is the iconic role, the thing you remember from this film, as Mrs. Danvers. She is serving you so much while remaining so still, while seeming to show you so little. She's expressionless throughout this film. And the scene where she strokes the narrator's face with that mink coat sleeve, you know, that just launched 1,000 queer media studies thesis papers. You know, like, that's seminal, as it were. This movie, though, that we're dealing with now, is anti all of that, anti-horny, anti-swooning, at least in the performances. Hitchcock, as you mentioned, I should use shadow and light to drive home all her alienation, her isolation. And instead, we get this really ham-fisted scene at the ball that is meant to show the narrator's mental breakdown, and it just lies there. It just doesn't do the work it's meant to do. The person who is doing the work they're meant to do is Kristin Scott Thomas. As you mentioned, Ayesha, she is great. She's very precise. She's making very specific choices. But, and I want to talk about this, because she is so comparatively grounded in the beginning, the journey she must take is a much longer one than Judith Anderson's was in the 1940s film. Like, Mrs. Danvers was already pretty close to the edge from the jump in that movie. Here, she's got a lot more ground to cover, and I didn't necessarily buy it all the way. But it's very pretty, right? I mean, Monte Carlo looks colorful, and the sets look fantastic. And if you go into this movie with nothing to compare it to, you will not spend the entire time comparing it to that thing, which is what I did.
Yeah. All right, Stephen, you are a fan of the Hitchcock film, so you have sort of the same frame of reference as Glenn. What did you think?
Yeah, I'm in a little bit of the same boat as Glenn. I've seen the original Rebecca probably a dozen times. It's just a movie that I've kind of come back to again and again, and made the mistake of revisiting it immediately before watching this remake. Yeah. And man, I mean, it really cannot help but massively fail in comparison. I mean, when you were putting directors side by side, like, I don't watch an Alfred Hitchcock movie and think, like, what's Ben Wheatley's take? And that's kind of what this movie's giving me a little bit. I do think it's fine to remake an 80-year-old movie and kind of try to make it feel a little more contemporary. I think it makes some choices that make a certain amount of sense. I think the Maxim De Winter character is really off-putting in the Hitchcock film. Laurence Olivier gives him a real creepster vibe. There's a lot of, like, oh, you silly little idiot. You know, there's just a lot of that kind of stuff that this movie very wisely takes away. It makes him less condescending and mean, and makes the Lily James version of the Joan Fontaine character, gives her more agency, makes her a little bit less hapless. Again, on paper, I appreciate this. On paper, I think having Kristin Scott Thomas step into the Judith Anderson role as Mrs. Danvers, I think that's a brilliant piece of casting. I think I'm never going to object to seeing Kristin Scott Thomas in anything at this point. But man, this movie just did not hang together for me as having any real reason to exist. I think it massively biffs the ending. I think the original film, Rebecca, like a lot of movies of its era, does have this, its ending is very, very abrupt. You're watching kind of the counter on the little screen and there's like 2 minutes left, and like, how are they going to wrap this up in 2 minutes? And then boom, they wrap it up. This kind of drags that out in ways that didn't add anything. And so on paper, this felt like a real opportunity. I like all these actors, even Armie Hammer. I don't think he's properly cast in this, but the movie didn't hang together for me at all.
The place where I'm in a different position from all of you is that the book Rebecca was a very important book in my kind of young reader life. And my feeling about Rebecca has always been, it's actually a very dark story. It's not a love story. It's not really meant to end with a clinch. That's not what this book is. Some of the things that Stephen noted, particularly about the character of Maxim de Winter, that comes straight from the book. The fact that in the book, he says to her at one point, I'm old enough to be your father. So he's much older than she is in the book. He had a long history of being married to Rebecca. Mrs. Danvers is a much older woman in the book because there's a reference to her, which they carried over into this film, but it doesn't really make any sense, her talking about having taking care of Rebecca when she was very young. Because if you sort of try to put those stories together, it's like, how old are all these people? How long was Maxim married to her? And how did she become this legendary mistress of this estate? They've clearly gone in a kind of a more matinee idol version of Maxim de Winter, which I think ultimately doesn't work. Because one of the problems is when you go for a much more romantic Maxim, I'll compare, for example, in the book, the way that he winds up proposing to the Lily James character. In the book, he proposes to her by sort of, she comes and says, oh, you know, I'm leaving. I have to go back to wherever with this woman that I work for. And he says, well, let's go down and sit and have a meal and discuss it. And they go sit down in the thing at the beautiful hotel. And he's like, well, you could do that or you could come with me. I'm asking you, as Stephen said, I'm asking you to marry me, you dumb dodo bird or whatever he says.
You little idiot. Yeah.
Whereas in this film, as soon as she says, like, I'm leaving, he's like, oh, but you should marry me. And they clinch. And it says that is not him in the book. Right. But by going for that very, like, much more traditionally romantic love, then when the story moves to Manderley, the estate where Maxim lives, you get a story where all of a sudden it doesn't make any sense. Because if he's this wonderful matinee romantic hero, why doesn't she feel like she can go and say, by the way, your housekeeper is torturing me?
Right.
By the way, you know, do you really love me? Because if you don't get that kind of distant, withdrawn quality to him, then nothing else that happens in the story really makes very much sense to me. And I agree with Aisha that the stuff that is so interesting about this story is the jealousy and possessiveness between all of these people and kind of this young woman trying to kind of make her way into the heart of her own husband and trying to figure out whether that's really possible. And this very complicated relationship that Mrs. Danvers has had with both Rebecca and Maxim. So I just don't ultimately think it works at all. And we referenced, I'm going to talk a little bit about the ending here. So just be prepared. The book has an extremely famous first sentence, which is, last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again. At the end of the book, in like one paragraph, just like Glenn was saying about the movie, they're driving back to Manderley and all of a sudden it's like, oh, we looked over and realized that the sky was glowing and ashes were blowing in our face and the house was on fire. The end. That's how the book ends. Here, they decided to drag it out into this weird, I mean, you'll see it if you watch the movie. It's a complete abandonment of not just the ending of the movie, which they changed massively, but the feel of the ending of the movie, yes, which is very kind of ambiguous and abrupt. And you don't get the feeling that you get from the book, which is this woman kind of looking back and trying to explain her marriage from a position of being older now. Actually, I have nothing against Armie Hammer. I think, like, Maxim de Winter is supposed to be played by, I don't know, like, it's not Paul Giamatti, but it's like, it's a more downbeat person. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know, Linda. I think you might be onto something there, because Giamatti can smolder and can express rage in a way that poor Armie, in that scene where he's like, oh, there's the famous Maxim de Winter anger. It's like, oh, he just stared at you. That's what's going on there.
The way I took that ending was the movie attempting to be more modern, to give her, the Mrs. de Winter, second Mrs. de Winter character, more agency. And to me, it just kind of fell flat in that way. Just like, I kind of think that even though the Laurence Olivier version, he's a tool, he's a jerk. Even though that's true, he's way more interesting than whatever, because Armie Hammer is playing him in a very flat, cardboardy way. I also think the script doesn't really do him any favors. He just kind of exists and you don't quite understand why she would be drawn to him except for his money. And I guess at the beginning, he's nicer to her than her employer. So played by Ann Dowd, who I actually thought was also really, she was hamming it up and I appreciated that. So
boy,
it was very fun.
Chewing on that role.
Chewy, chewy.
One thing that this movie gets right is that, you know, 80 years of technology can work, right? So now we can shoot on the Cornish cliffs and they look amazing. Everything in the 1940 film was shot on a Hollywood soundstage, even the exteriors. And that is some crazy, fakey rear projection stuff going on there. Every ride in a car they take is a big Toons is the Driving Cat moment. It's something.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I think you can tell that none of us were huge fans of this, but it is available on Netflix if you are interested in checking it out. Tell us what you think about Rebecca. Maybe we're wrong. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor WeTransfer. We all have doubts, but where do they belong? Are they simply to be surfaced and forgotten? WeTransfer believes your doubt needs a place where it can grow into something useful, and WeTransfer's set of tools can help you do just that by collecting, sketching, presenting, and sharing your thoughts with the world. It's where doubt transforms into ideas. Meet Paste, Paper, and Collect by WeTransfer. Go to toolstomoveideas.com to learn more.
Support also comes from Madewell. Their experts use premium fabric and the latest denim technology to make jeans in fits and styles for everyone. Whether you're looking for a super comfy pair that really moves with you or want to keep it old school in 100% cotton, you're sure to find jeans you're going to reach for again and again. Go to Madewell.com and use the code NPRDENIM for $20 off your online jeans purchase. Terms apply. Please see Madewell.com/promos for full offer details.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week. And let's face it, every week, what is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, Betty?
Well, it's been years since I have hijacked the happy segment on this show to shill for my own work shamelessly. It was kind of a staple, a hallmark of the early years of the show. Don't you miss it? Don't you miss it? Some of you people just about missed it. I've got a loophole here because while there is something new I can promote, I had nothing to do with it, which is my first book, Superman, the Unauthorized Biography, which is a cultural history of the character, only came out in hardback. No paperback, no audiobook. Well, now there is an audiobook. I had no idea it happened, but I'm very glad it did because over the years, you know, a couple people, more than one, have asked me if it was ever going to happen, and I was certain it wasn't. So this audiobook is read by George Newbern, who voiced Superman on the old Justice League animated series that I love.
From Father of the Bride.
Fancy.
And Father of the Bride, sure. So, I mean, if it couldn't be me, can't think of a better choice. He does a great job. It's available wherever you get your audiobooks, and that's Superman, the Unauthorized Biography by Glenn. I can't read my notes here. Looks like Waldron. Does that make sense? Waldron. On Waldron.
All right. That is a great book. I encourage all of you to check it out. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Aisha Harris, what is making you happy this week, friend?
The thing that is making me happy this week has actually been making me happy for a very long time, at least the last like year or two, which is Tom Bryan's The Number Ones column on Stereo Gum. He has basically for the last couple of years been writing about every single Billboard Hot 100 number one, starting from the very beginning. He's going day by day. I think it's 5 days a week. And it is just such a delight to read about random number ones that I like had never even heard of. And then also reading about ones that I'm super familiar with. And he just does a really good job of putting each song into context, offering his own perspective on them, giving like sharing really random back bits of trivia, things that like you might have heard or things that you have never heard of. It's like watching sort of one of those VH1 countdown episodes from the late 90s and the early 2000s, except like way more informed and way more thoughtful. He rates everyone on a scale of 1 to 10 at the end. So it's really fun to read and try to figure out where he's going and then see what his ultimate ranking is. As of this recording, the last one he wrote is Tears for Fears. Fears is Shout, which I'm excited to read. I am many weeks behind, but I highly recommend everyone check it out. It's Tom Bryan's The Number Ones on Stereo Gum.
Thank you very much, Aisha Harris. I would read that. Thank you very much for passing it along. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
What's making me happy is this kind of weird impromptu TikTok project from a couple weeks back. It doesn't have like an official name, but we're going to call it Fighting in a Grocery Store. And I don't know if any of you have seen this, but a TikTok user named Daniel J. Mertzluft, that's with two Fs, recorded a musical theater parody in a grocery store with little captions to kind of note the theater tropes that he's covering. So he is standing in a grocery store and he delivers this very theatrical number.
And we're fighting in a grocery store, and I love you, but I don't know if I like you anymore. We're standing right in aisle 9, and you promised everything's fine.
So it's cute, right? It's a theater guy in quarantine times kind of making the most of this medium to just kind of make fun of like things that pop up in a lot of musical theater. Then other TikTok users used TikTok's duet feature to add other characters concurrently with his performance and kind of overlaying them to deepen the scene. So a user named Another.Blonde was first. She made the song a duet, kind of completing the couple.
And we're fighting in a grocery store.
Does it push the joke too far? It is the internet, so yes, it does. Mm-hmm. Other users pop up. Somebody adds the performance of a plaintive child, a store employee, a can of soup. I won't spoil them all, but people kind of keep adding different things that you might find in a grocery store. Over time, I think it becomes kind of a little bit too chaotic to work. Eventually, it's just this smashing together of voices. I found it to be kind of strangely moving the way the internet can kind of create something and then bend it in real time in really interesting and strangely sweet and profound and baffling ways. So that's Fighting in a Grocery Store on TikTok. In the Pop Culture Happy Hour newsletter, we'll throw up a link to the Twitter thread that kind of links all of these in order.
Very good. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Sounds right up my alley.
Yes.
What is making me happy this week? I, as we tape this, was on vacation last week, so I have all kinds of things to report. But I'm going to talk about the show Grand Designs. Grand Designs is a UK show. There are 20 seasons or more maybe now. Four of them are available through kind of legit streaming options in the United States. Two seasons are on Netflix, two seasons are on Amazon. I don't know why that is. That's just how it has shaken out. Grand Designs involves a guy named Kevin MacLeod, who's sort of he's the host, and he is an expert, it appears, on building and construction. And he goes around and visits these extremely ambitious, sometimes bizarre, sometimes very Fitzcarraldo kind of ways that people want to build a house for themselves. They're all self-run, so it's the person building their own home. Most of them are smart enough to have an architect and a general contractor. Not all. One is this guy who wants to restore a castle, but he has no idea what he's doing. And you can tell that the entire time Kevin MacLeod wants to be like, just stop. There is a fondness in a lot of these projects for a certain aesthetic that I would call underfunded museum, which is like just a box with a lot of concrete floors. And like people get to the point where they're like, I'm going to be very innovative and use just ugly corrugated metal on the outside of my house. And then eventually you're like, yep, like everyone else. The show is so unpredictable and yet somehow comforting. So again, Grand Designs, two seasons on Netflix, two seasons on Amazon. And that is what is making me happy this week. We should also mention, we are entering a very exciting new era of the show. As you know, we have been building the team here. Not only do we have the great Aisha Harris with us as a host now, but we also have our great friend Mike Katziff, who came back to us to produce again, our new producer Candace Lim. And all of this is part of heading toward, we are going to be able to come to you starting October 26th, 5 days a week. Now, if you like the Wednesday and Friday shows approximately as they are, they're going to be very similar to what you know now. We'll be in different combinations with lots of different great guests. But if you've been with us long enough to have ever listened to our kind of small batch episodes, which were these little kind of shorter conversations, maybe just two people, we're going to talk about a lot of interesting stuff. It's going to expand what we're able to do. You guys, I am so excited. Aisha, We are so happy to have you with us for this exciting phase of our development.
Oh, seriously.
I'm so excited to be here.
It's going to be so much fun. We are super, super happy. And again, that's starting October 26th. Just keep it on the same feed. You do not have to do anything to get those. And also, by the way, subscribe to the newsletter, npr.org/popculturenewsletter. That's a great way to also keep up with everything that we're doing in this very, very, very exciting time. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. Glenn is at GH Weldon, and Aisha is at Crafting My Style. You can find our editor, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, our producer, Candace Lim, at The Candace Lim, and you can find our producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, still provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. We will see you all 5 times next week.
Voting is crucial. And I don't give a damn how you look at it.
Is this America?
It was we, the people.
The land of the free and the home of the brave.
Not we, the white male citizens.
Misrepresentative Democracy.
A new series about voting in America from NPR's Throughline.
Listen now.